I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Like many of you, I have been mostly working from home for nearly a year now because of the coronavirus pandemic. And when I'm in the office, as I am today, it's still jarring to see all the empty desks and hallways and the skeletal crew that's here to keep the station on the air. As it turns out, some 40% of American workers are doing their jobs remotely, and about a third of them say that they want to continue working from home post-pandemic. Now, these are white-collar jobs that rely on things like computers and phones to get the work done. But working remotely has its stresses and its challenges, turning kitchens, bedrooms, basements into offices, juggling the demands of both work and home, especially when it involves childcare and school-aged children, spotty Wi-Fi connections, too many Zoom meetings, and not enough water cooler chit-chat with colleagues. In the first part of our Friday, February series exploring how COVID has changed the way we work, we look today at what has turned out to be a forced remote work experiment and discuss how it's working for you. And we want to hear from you. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me introduce our two guests. Barbara Larson is Executive Professor of Management at the DeMoor McKim School of Business at Northeastern University, where her research focuses on remote and virtual work. And she joins us by Skype. Barbara Larson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Good morning, Marty.
Good morning. Also with us is Derek Thompson, and he's staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media, author of Hitmakers and host of the podcast Crazy Genius. Derek Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let me start with a personal question. Since we're talking about working remotely, let me begin with you, Derek. How has remote work worked for you?
That is a great question. So it is true. I do work remotely. I have worked semi-remotely for a few years now as a writer at The Atlantic. I have been writing from various couches and kitchen islands for a long, long time. I wrote my book, Hitmakers, that you mentioned at home. I suppose that a lot of book writing, if not all book writing, is somewhat remote work. You're remote from just about everybody else because it's such an isolating experience. And so I would say, overall, I've had a lot of practice doing remote work, but at the same time, I also feel very keenly right now the deficit of human interaction. And that, I think, is partly because of remote work, but it's also partly because of the pandemic and my inability to see people in restaurants and bars. And I think that's an important point going forward that we can talk about in a second, is just that it's really difficult, I think, to extrapolate current remote work experiences forward, because hopefully, if there is a positive future of remote work and working from home or working from anywhere, it's not going to be a future that exists under the pall of a perma-pandemic.
And that's something to certainly keep in mind. Barbara, let me put the same question to you, and picking up on what Derek said, says, because in certain ways, work is about work, but it also has this really powerful social part as well. Can you speak to that? And how are you doing with remote work?
Yeah, thanks, Marty. It does. I think that, I completely agree with what Derek just said. I think that, as I talk to workers individually, as I talk to executives, representing larger organizations, the number one thing that I'm hearing at this point in the pandemic is the issue of social isolation. That is really what's dragging people down. And I think that, as Derek said, this is something that is going to certainly be, not eliminated once the pandemic subsides, but is going to be significantly reduced. And I, I've had the same experience. I've been working from a couple of different dining room tables in two different households. I live in the city, and so as I think possibly Derek does as well, and I do not have the advantage of dedicated workspace, and so I've been feeling it, and I have a child who's in hybrid, part-time remote learning. So I've been experiencing the same thing that a lot of people have with pandemic remote work. But I see a much brighter future for non-pandemic remote work, actually. And I'm, looking forward to talking about that some. One other thing I want to say that
sure,
I think is interesting is that Derek and I both sort of have the same experience of having already done remote work because of the nature of the work that we do, and, you know, which is more knowledge-based and more, you know, sort of digitally enabled. And I think that also speaks to the experience that people have been having with the pandemic in general, you know, in terms of their fortunes you know, those of us who have been privileged to be in jobs that already were suited for remote work have not had the same experience with the pandemic economically that many others in different sectors have had.
And I do want to pick up on all of that, but also as both of you were talking, I was thinking about myself personally speaking here, and then we will certainly move on to other issues and to our listeners as well. But obviously, you know, I don't have to commute into work and I'm going to have all this extra time on my hands, but I'm finding that my work day doesn't seem any less. And I think in part it's because I have a team of producers, and when we're in the office all together, or when we talked all day long about things that came up and talking about guests and all that kind of stuff. And now that requires phone calls or texting or Slacking, or it just feels like all the technology and tools there that are wonderful also make things complicated. And I wonder if you could speak to that, Derek.
Yeah, I mean, I think that going forward, it's going to be really, really tough for organizations that were built to be office-based organizations to become remote-first organizations. I think that is the really important challenge that a lot of companies are facing, because, you know, you have a handful of projects that are easily converted into remote work structures. There are software teams that, for example, have been remote for many years. You can imagine a relationship between a writer and an editor being remote, and it has been for a long time. I'm sure maybe for over 100 years. I mean, I don't know if, you know, Herman Melville was like walking down to the cafe to hang out with his editor.
Yeah, I doubt
he might
it.
Have just been shipping the you know, the copies of Moby Dick a couple hundred miles or a couple dozen miles, yep. And it was being edited remotely. But there's a whole host of other jobs that have relied on this phalanx of real world interactions, whether it's conferences and meetings and more meetings and more meetings. I mean, so much of white collar work these days is just a cavalcade of one meeting after another. And converting those interactions into a remote work structure, right, I think is more challenging than just firing up Zoom, because creativity and psychological safety, these things require, I think, a kind of easy back and forth between participants in the office or even in the virtual office. And sometimes I think it's harder to have that honest flow of ideas when you can't just see the people that you're talking to on a casual Monday, Tuesday afternoon to be like, did you catch The Bachelor last night? What did you think about the football game the other day? Those sort of casual interactions are the carrier wave of psychological safety and creativity. And with that, and I think that the challenge for remote work going forward is going to be to find ways, right, to recapture the magic of those non-work interactions that make work more productive.
Well, let me toss that to you, Barbara, because you have thought about this, about how to make these Zoom, you know, there are other ways that people connect on Teams and through Slack channels and stuff like that, but how to make them, yeah, more productive, but also how to create those moments, the sort of serendipitous moments that can happen when you're on the job and you bump into someone and then you start talking and lo and behold, you've come up with an idea. How do we do that when we're not together?
Yeah,
when we're
I mean, come up with an idea or solved a problem. Actually, I have been talking to people a good bit about this lately, and actually had an article on HBR.org a few months ago. There are ways to structure unstructured interaction, right, online, and some companies are much further ahead on this. I, you know, talked to a top executive at Logmein, which is, you know, a tech company, a competitor with Zoom and Skype for that matter, and there's an executive there who leads a team of 2,000 people, and he has been a remote leader almost his entire career, actually, even predating his time at Lagmian. And he has some great practices for enabling unstructured collaboration virtually. And, one of the things he does, which I think is a best practice for just about every manager these days, is virtual office hours. And he says he finds that his sort of one-off 20, 30-minute Zoom meetings go down, or not Zoom, obviously. In his case, it would be another product.
Right.
But that his number of these, you know, tiny, just nonstop one-on-one meetings goes down dramatically when people know they can find him, in his virtual office, at given hours, and that the entire team is invited, and also that often the people show up with the same issues, and so then they can get things resolved much more quickly. Another thing that he does, which I've actually quite a few people have started doing lately, is just having people get onto Zoom or an equivalent platform, Teams, and just work together.
Right.
And so,
keep it on.
I equate that to, like, you know, what you had in college, a study buddy. You know, you'd go to the library together, or a workout buddy. You go to the gym together. You know, you're not necessarily doing a lot of things together during that time, but you're keeping each other company. You're keeping each other going, and you're occasionally, you know, asking questions or benefiting from each other's presence. And yes, so people designate a time. They get on, a video conferencing platform. They sort of set ground rules about how they're going to work together, and they have some social interaction, but then they work. And I've seen this now. I've started seeing academics doing this. There's a group of OB researchers who are now scheduling writing times together, from all over the world, and they get together on a common platform. And so this is, I think, going to be one of the ways that we deal with this lack of social interaction.
Derek, we're almost up in a break here, but I'm thinking how, technology, we used to complain, or maybe I used to complain a couple of years ago, it drives us all apart, and now it's keeping us all together, but it's still a new technology that we're still trying to figure out.
Yeah, I think that it's a mistake when we think about the past as being bad and the future as being good.
Right.
There were a set of problems that were inherent to the office-based culture, and there will be a new, exciting set of problems inherent to remote work culture. We're replacing one set of problems with a different set of problems, but I do think that for a lot of teams and a lot of different cultures, there will be tremendous upsides to moving to remote work.
And that is Derek Thompson, who joins us along with Barbara Larson. We are talking about working from home or working from somewhere else, certainly not working at work, working remotely. We want to know how this is working for you. If you are one of those 40% of Americans who are doing their jobs remotely, do you feel more or less productive? Do you miss some of that water cooler chit chat? And are you thinking of moving because perhaps you don't have to commute anymore? You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times and 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, and we are beginning a Friday, February, a look at how the coronavirus pandemic has upended the world of work. Today, we're talking about or looking at this experiment that was kind of foisted on us, and that is remote working. About 40% of Americans are working from home or working from somewhere else. We're talking about things like productivity and the social aspects of work and how to make that happen under these remote experiences. Barbara Larson, Executive Professor of Management at the DeMoor McKim School of Business at Northeastern University, and her research does focus on remote and virtual work. Derek Thompson with us as well, staff writer at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, technology, and the media. Let me read a bunch of comments here. One from Mary, who left a comment on our Facebook page. I'm working from home, and while I appreciate the lack of commute, I miss being in the office. I'm an introvert, and working from home full time lets me pull too far into myself. Very interesting, Mary. Chris says, I've been working from home and in software my entire career. I'm very grateful and privileged that my work hasn't been impacted in any way by the pandemic. It's refreshing to see that the world is learning that tech has also what tech has known for decades. You do not need butts in seats to be productive. I'd like to see this continue, but friends' experiences sadly show otherwise. An email from Kyle, cutting my two-hour commute out of my day has given me so much more time to be productive at work, spending time with my family, reduce the amount of wear and tear on my car, and almost eliminate my fuel use. Those are some of the people who have sent us messages here at Radio Times. You can do that as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Barbara, let me just go quickly for you, and Derek, I have a question for you as well. Are you finding, picking up on some of what our listeners were saying, that people are more productive working at home, or does it vary on what the job is, or even the kind of personality that someone has, or maybe even all the distractions and demands of home?
Yes, and yes. I think I was smiling and nodding as you were reading some of the comments from your listeners, because they do reflect so much what we've been seeing in research, both research that's been done during the COVID pandemic, but research on work from home more broadly. And as Derek, I'm very cautious about interpreting any data that's been gathered during the COVID pandemic as being representative of work from home and remote work more generally, because I think that's just not the case.
Sure.
But there have been studies on both work from home and what's called work from anywhere, where people can actually live wherever they want, that indicate that for certain types of work, typically more independent work, that doesn't require as much collaboration with coworkers, that that productivity does increase or can increase if employees are taken out of the office and moved to work from home. And then, you know, we found on a study of patent examiners that was published last year that even moving them from work to home to work from anywhere, giving them that additional degree of freedom can further increase productivity. Huh. And so I think, you know, your software engineer who was, you know, commenting that, you know, people in tech have known this for a long time, I think the data in some experimental studies, so where we have, you know, sort of causal results, bears that out. And you're starting to see that now in companies like Facebook, you know, announcing that they are going to implement work from anywhere policies across broad classes of largely independent workers, such as senior software engineers. You're starting to see this play out in real life.
Derek, I want to pick up on that and something that you've written about that's really actually fascinating to think about, which is if once this pandemic is over and people, I guess, have the option of going back to work, and who will go back and who will stay, nonetheless, we're probably going to see more remote work. And how is that going to change, you know, the restaurants that cater to workers, you know, around the corner, or public transportation, or even if you can work from anywhere, do you need to live in a city where the rents are, you know, $5,000 a month?
I think it's a great question. And, you know, I don't know for sure, but I'm really interested in some of the theories being developed by people like David Autor, this economist that I've spoken with a few times. He is interested in this idea that he calls telepresence. What will telepresence do to the workforce and to the economy writ large? What will it mean if people can be equally present at work from their kitchen island and having that butt in that seat in that office? So one of the interesting implications is that, well, if people are going to the office a little bit less, and he's not predicting, and I certainly don't want to make it seem like I'm predicting, that this is somehow the end of offices. I just think that this is going to be an important marginal change going forward, that fewer people might come into the office on a daily basis. But if that happens, all right, well, what are the spillover effects on local businesses in central business districts, those restaurants that rely on business lunches, those shops that rely on people walking from the office to business lunches and, you know, might stop by that shop in order to buy something. What happens to all of these companies? I think let's maybe even talk about people who work in offices and help with the upkeep and clean offices. What happens to this entire economy that is currently oriented around a certain assumption of filled offices and bustling central business districts? It's possible that those central business districts just won't necessarily be quite as bustling, that it will just be a little bit different in terms of the culture of coming into the office. And so I think this is a good and interesting way to think about how the changes that we're talking about in terms of remote work won't be bound to remote work. They will spill over into things like the distribution of jobs and employment in downtown areas.
Well, I'm just thinking if for those kinds of jobs and those kinds of people, you can work from anywhere, you could be in Des Moines or Vermont or an island somewhere. I mean, just the options are limitless, it seems, Derek.
Right. And so this is, I think, the responsible way to think about this is to say that for hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, the logic of urban economics was you work where you live. And this, by the way, I suppose was the logic of not just urban economics, but just all economics. I mean, even if you were a agrarian farmer in early 19th century America, you literally lived where you worked because your farm life was your home life. What remote work does is it loosens that historical tether between work and home. And so different people, based on their preferences, are going to deal with that loosened tether differently. Some people who just love cities and really kind of like going into the office are going to say, I'm going to deal with that loosened tether by changing nothing, right? And this might even be the majority of people who say, I'm not going to change my behavior in the 2020s compared to what I was doing in the 2010s. But I think a lot of other families are going to say, well, if the tether's a little bit longer, if the leash is a little bit longer, maybe I don't have to live downtown right next to my office. I can live like an hour outside, have like a bigger house, a bigger lawn that my kids can play on with my dogs, my cats. And I might only come into the office a handful of times a week. I'll become what is sometimes in economics known as a super commuter. Right. You make less frequent commutes, but those commutes are longer. And then other people are going to interpret this loosened leash, this elongated tether between work and life by saying, you know what? I like Philadelphia where I work. I like Washington, D.C. where I work. But I want to live closer to my family, or I want to just live in Wyoming or Montana. It's always been a dream of mine. I want to move to Idaho. And so they'll do that. And given this experience that we've all gone through, both that worker and that worker's boss will recognize that a lot of the activity that they are doing on a day-to-day basis can be done virtually. So it doesn't matter what state or really even what country that person lives in. But I think it's important to think about these three categories, because I think that a lot of people listening might easily slot themselves into one of those three categories and not imagine making the other two decisions. But that's why it's important to recognize that, like, people's preferences are really, really diverse, and they're going to react to this loosened leash very differently.
And we are talking about working from home or remote work or working from anywhere, and how the pandemic has frankly forced a lot of people to work from home. And the question is, once the pandemic is over, what will the world of work look like? And that's Derek Thompson. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic. Barbara Larson as well, executive professor of management at Northeastern University. Let me read a couple of comments here. And Barbara, I want to go back to you. Matthew says, I love working from home. My wife has her office and I'm in the basement, so we each have a clear space of our own. I'm sure my coworkers would be mad at me for saying this, but I would be willing to forego any planned yearly raises for the next few years if it meant I got to work from home instead. And then he goes on to say, the money I'm saving, by the way, of not commuting is more than a yearly merit raise would be. Very interesting. A tweet from Mark, I've been fortunate to work for a commercial bakery in the area, having been working normally with bigger volume over the last year due to COVID and more people shopping. Have been working normally. he says. Email from Dave. My experience is that my work life has become more casual and less time consuming. No commute, no boring meetings, more time with my kids, more time in my garden. Life is good. That's from Dave. Barbara, let me pick up. And as you mentioned, you've got a child at home. And this is just based on my anecdotal conversations with friends and family. People that I know with children at home who are working are tearing their hair out. And it's just, you know, trying to manage work, trying to manage remote schooling, trying to manage, you know, a three-year-old running around, that this is really, really, really difficult. What advice or what counsel can you give some of these families? Do we have Barbara?
Sorry about that. Yes, okay. The remote work researcher. I'm famous for muting myself and forgetting.
Okay.
Honestly, my advice is less for families at this point and more for employers and governments. I think, you know, there's enormous amounts of evidence that have come out and been published by economists and sociologists in the last year showing the impact that having the children at home during COVID is having on workers, and particularly on women, but even on men who are parents, that, you know, I think a little over an eighth of women and men during the early stages of the pandemic left their jobs or reduced their hours to care for children.
Wow.
And that, you know, as you look at current unemployment statistics, the job losses are disproportionately borne by women and in even more disproportionately borne by women of color. I think this speaks to the lack of, an approach. I mean, I will say personally in my situation, I'm someone who does remote work. And so obviously, I mean, my sort of the demand for my time, my workload has increased dramatically in the last year. And I made a decision, you know, along with my son's father to invest essentially in having childcare available for my child during remote schooling. And I'm also lucky in that my school district has emphasized getting children back into school. And so now my child is going to school in person 2 days a week. And I think that one thing we've seen is that there's increasing evidence from school districts who have been bringing kids back into the classroom that if you manage it well with, you know, hybrid, you know, and masking and social distancing, that there's actually been very little in-school transmission of COVID. And so now I think, you know, one thing I'm seeing that I think is hopeful is that the Biden administration is making getting kids back into school a priority. And this is going to be an absolute lifeline for working parents. And also, frankly, better for the kids.
And
that's not something that I would have necessarily advocated for a year ago. But we've seen, you know, we now have the evidence. We've seen the impact that homeschooling has had on both kids and parents and you know, in the workplace and at home. And it is time to get kids back to school. And I think, you know, the other thing that I talk when I talk to companies about this, I talk really to the managers and the leadership of the companies about the need to support their working parents who have kids from home, because there's only so much you can do as an individual, you know, especially if you don't have the financial means to hire, you know, to hire childcare.
You know, I just want to say, and I have to say that next week we'll be looking at essential workers, but I do feel, Derek, in many ways, this is kind of a conversation for people of privilege, you know, who have probably the white collar jobs, the management jobs that can be done at home, that can think, oh, I'm going to move, you know, somewhere because I have the wherewithal to do that. I just want to sort of, you know, it seems that that's the segment of the population that we are talking about. I just want to give you a chance to weigh in on that.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I try to make this point as often as I can in my articles, close to the top of the articles, that what we're talking about here is the white-collar workforce. It's the knowledge economy. And as a share of the overall economy, you know, maybe it's 30%, maybe it's 40%. Certainly during the pandemic, a lot of jobs that typically would not be done remotely have been forced to happen remote, or a lot of work has just been shut down entirely. And so, yeah, it's always important to point out that, you know, working working remotely is not going to be an option for some of the most common jobs in the country. Hard to work remotely if you're a cashier. Hard to work remotely if you're a retail salesperson or a nurse or a home care aide. These are jobs that are really, really difficult to make virtual. And so when we're talking about the future of remote work, what we're talking about is a minority of a minority, because not only are we dealing with the minority of workers who are in the white-collar economy, the knowledge economy, software and media and PR and marketing, we're also probably talking about less than 50% of them that are going to want to be fully remote when things are, knock on wood, back to normal. However, even though we are just talking about a minority of a minority here, that number is still really important. Even if it's just 10%, 9% of the U.S. workforce that decides to essentially work remotely, that is a huge deal. And the way to think about that by analogy is to think about retail. So around 2015, about 9, 10% of retail was online, right? That's Amazon and Walmart.com and all the, you know, Chewy and all these other e-commerce retailers. Only 9% were online. But whenever you were talking about the future of retail on the radio with other retailers who had physical stores, you would always talk about the future of e-commerce. So that 9 or 10% of retail was the tail wagging the dog of the whole sector. So I think that even if just 9% of the U.S. workforce moves to remote work on a semi-permanent basis in 2022, 2023, you're still talking about millions and millions of people changing the way that they live and work, and that could still have a huge impact on all of us.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. This is the first of a series we're going to do, Fridays in February, looking at how the pandemic has changed the world of work. And just to repeat myself, we're talking about how more people are working remotely, in many ways forced to work remotely. Some are very happy about it, as we are hearing from our listeners. Some are struggling with it. And we're talking with Derek Thompson. He's staff writer for The Atlantic. He writes about economics, technology, and the media. Barbara Larson with us as well, executive professor of management at Northeastern University. Her research focuses on remote and virtual work. And we want to hear from you about how it's going if you are working from home or working from anywhere. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about working from home, how this experiment foisted on us because of the pandemic is working out. Something like 40% of Americans are working remotely. We're talking about what this says about the world of work, about that balance between home and work. What's going to happen in the future? Will we be back in the office or some version of both? Let me go back to you, Barbara Larson, and just talk a little bit about when you're working from home, how to find that divide between home and work, whether that gets blurred when the office is in the living room or in the kitchen or in the basement, and where you are tethered to work because of, through social media. So you always feel like you're always on. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that people have struggled with over the last year. One of the things that I often talk about, and others do as well, is this idea of having different types of boundaries within the home, and they can be physical boundaries. If you're lucky enough to have a dedicated office, like some of your listeners have talked about, that's great, right? Then you really do have a physical boundary. When you go in your office, you can even sort of train your family members. When I go in my office, I'm in work mode. When I come out of my office, I'm available for you. If you don't have a physical boundary, though, I've heard great stories about, you know, people who have established physical boundaries for themselves, even when they're working and living in the same space. You know, there was one, you know, sort of anecdote about someone who, a writer who was getting up at the end of the day and moving to the other end of the sofa. And that was, you know, sort of his sort of sign, like, okay, it's time to, you know, I'm now in home mode. I'm no longer in work mode. So I think, you know, their physical boundaries, their behavioral boundaries, you know, sometimes people pour themselves a drink at the end of the day. There are phrases that people use to designate to themselves, okay, that's it. You know, I'm done. And then, as I said, you know, interpersonal boundaries of really establishing norms within your, you know, whoever you live with, as to, you know, this is when we're on, this is when we're off. So there are ways to do it, and I think people are getting better and better at it. But you know, it is something that really you need to invest in. It's not going to happen organically. One other thing I just want to, if you don't mind, Marty, other thing I wanted to address that was just following on from before the break is, you know, the impact that Derek was talking about of having, you know, these additional folks working from home who hadn't been previously. And I think this is something he's written about and something that I talk about a lot with people is that I think one of the biggest changes that we're going to see going forward that's going to be a huge boon actually after the pandemic is this change in culture around the way that work from home is perceived. And I think this is going to be massive and really game changing for us, at least here, you know, in the U.S. That, you know, previously there in many companies, there was sort of this unspoken stigma around work from home that, well, you did it if you had to do it, you know, because you're not, you know, you're raising your kids, you're not totally into work as much as you are when you're in the office. And I think so much of that stigma is going to go away. It has already gone away, in part because those of us who, you know, those who were in the office previously, you know, now understand that people who work from home work really hard. And but also just that we can be productive when we're working from home. And so I think that as I think about future of work, that is the real shift that I'm predicting.
Derek, let me read a tweet and then we'll get Steve from Reading to join us. So the tweet says, for those of us who are no longer working but still have to go into the city or other congested areas for things like medical appointments, the drop in traffic and commuting times has been a blessing. And I drove into work today, come down I-95 under normal circumstances. You know, it takes an hour. Today it took 40 minutes because, frankly, there was less traffic. And I'm just thinking about how this maybe temporarily, maybe permanently, thinking about even public transportation, how just the world of commuting has really changed, at least momentarily.
Right. And this is another place, I think, where it's going to be difficult to figure out, to disentangle how much of what we are seeing is a pandemic effect and how much of it is a work from home effect that's going to outlast the pandemic. So, you know, there was an interesting study that was done by the Federal Reserve looking at super commuters, people who, you know, drive, you know, 45 minutes to an hour every day or longer. And it discovered something kind of like an iron law of commuting, that when people move from, say, 15 minutes away from their place of work to an hour and 30 minutes outside of their place of work, they will essentially adjust the frequency of their commutes such that the total amount of commuting time is essentially the same. So, you know, if you move, you know, five times further away from the office, you'll still commute, you'll just commute five times less. And that would suggest that we shouldn't be too optimistic about, you know, the highways remaining as unclogged as they currently are. Just for so much of American history, the rule just of overall driving has been that you build more highways and people just drive more. Yep. So I'm not sure how much of that is going to change after the pandemic. But look, there are certainly implications, spillover effects, as I've called them, of less commuting on things like taxes, If people drive less, if that's really what's going to happen, that there's going to be a significant decline in overall driving, that's fantastic for lots of reasons. It means that, you know, commute times are going to fall and there's going to be less traffic and fewer accidents. That's all good news. But it could also mean that there gas taxes decline and highway tickets and fares decline, in which case we need to find new sources of revenue. I'm not saying that these are, you know, house on fire problems, but I think it just goes to show how, you know, the little tiny pebble falls into the lake and the ripple effects can be surprisingly broad.
Yeah, and how sort of interconnected everything is. Let me get Steve from Reading to join our conversation. And Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. I'm a pastor of a church in Reading, about an hour from Philly. And we've been completely online since March 8th was our last Sunday we were in house. We've never gone back, and I've done everything online almost, except for a few hospital calls. It's completely changed everything I do and the way I do my job, and I've had to learn a lot of great new skills, which has been positive, but I'm an extrovert. I haven't had a chance to be with people, to talk with, you know, I mean, that's what I do. And the other side of it, too, is when this started, I predicted that two-thirds or three-quarters of the churches in the country would close, because most of the churches in America are on the edge anyway. And this has been a really tough year financially. We've done okay, but it's only been because we've had a couple of people really pitch in, but a lot of places are struggling.
Yeah. And Steve, I'm curious, I'm assuming you do pastoral counseling and you use Zoom or other technologies like that. How has that been for you?
It's, again, it's not the same. It, for some people, it's better. For other people, it's worse. The bad parts is when I've had people die, and we've had a number of folks die from COVID, not being able to do funeral services, or I've done a few, but they've been very short, graveside. People don't get that chance to be with their friends that they, you know, were in church for 50 years together, and some folks are holding off and may never do them. Weddings, baptisms, that sort of thing. I know there are churches doing in person, and I know that some of them have tried and then gone back to online because COVID would break out. We're super spreaders, and so we have to be responsible to our people's lives, even if sometimes they don't want to be themselves.
Well, I really appreciate your call to Radio Times. Barbara, anything you want to say to Steve?
You know, I did I was asked to speak to a group of women leaders at Princeton Theological Seminary relatively early in the pandemic. And so much, it was honestly, of all the sessions I've done over the last year, that was probably the most wrenching for all the reasons that Steve mentions. And just the fact that these were, you know, leaders, pastors who were, you know, as Steve said, themselves trying to completely shift the way in which their organizations operated, you know, and often with, you know, older staff, you know, low investment in technology, you know, none of the benefits of the corporate world. And then on top of that, we're dealing with just immense personal tragedy, not only the sort of life events that Steve was mentioning, but also just the heightened stress levels in their congregations, you know, for all the reasons we've been talking about. So I heard this early on, and I can't only imagine a year in, you know, it's got to be exhausting. And I really appreciate the work they've been doing.
Absolutely. Here's a question for you, Derek, coming from Joni. How do your guests think the longer leash will affect salaries? If you're getting a big city salary, but you're not living in that big city, will your pay change? Or perhaps I could even reframe it. Should your pay change?
It's a fantastic question that's going to be handled differently company to company and will also be contingent on other factors, like whether that hire is being made remotely or whether it is a local hire and the employee chooses to move a couple hundred or thousand miles away. Really hard to say anything too broadly here, but I do think that in the short term, it's unlikely to me that people are punished too dramatically for their decision to remain remote coming out of a pandemic, because then the company is essentially in the business of, you know, punishing an employee in exchange for their making a decision that is for the health of their family, right? So because we're coming out of a pandemic, I do think it's unlikely that you're going to see too many companies try overly dramatically to fit wage to the local price level of whatever city that person's living in. But over time, yes, I do think you are going to see some companies say, look, if we make the hire in San Francisco versus making the hire in, you know, rural Virginia, rural Pennsylvania, yeah, we are essentially going to be thinking of those things as being a different price point. It's totally possible.
Barbara, can I just turn that question on its head, yeah, whether people who do come into work, they don't want to, but it's essential that they be there. Do we reward them for going that extra mile?
I think that's a great question. I mean, I think we've seen, you know, some companies already putting a stake in the ground as far as, you know, lowering wages. Facebook was very explicit about this in its announcement of its work from anywhere policy. They said, yeah, you know, if we hire you in a lower cost of living area, geography, we're going to pay you less. I mean, they didn't use those words, but that was essentially the message. You know, I think as Derek says, I think that it's very much going to be a new sort of supply and demand set of dynamics that emerge. And so where you're going to be seeing the movement is when people move jobs. And, you know, and new hires into companies. I think it's, you know, in this type of environment, in many industries, it's very hard to make the argument that, you know, to an employer that, oh, you should be paying somebody more who has to come into the office. You know, in many industries, these people are, frankly, you know, happy to still be employed. But there are already industries that are, you know, desperate for workers. I mean, you look at, you know, the cybersecurity field, you look at, you know, cloud computing technologies, and I, you know, obviously a lot of those can be done remotely, but to the extent that there are fields where you need bodies in the office, and you know, and there's already, it's sort of a seller's market, there is going to be, you know, upward wage pressure as well.
Derek, as you look into the future, maybe even the distant future, are we looking at an all delivery economy? I mean, certainly we're seeing that now as people are buying so much stuff online and their trucks just everywhere, dropping off packages at people's apartments and houses. Do you see this as a temporary or a permanent thing?
God, what a great question. I think overall, what you should do when making predictions, this is my general rule, is to fit that prediction not only to the most recent pulse, the most recent phenomenon, but see if it holds before that phenomenon happened. So even before the pandemic hit, you were still seeing, for example, in the restaurant industry, that off-premise spending, that is essentially food delivery, right, was growing faster than on-premise spending, which is to say dine-in. There was a piece that I wrote, I remember, I believe in the summer of 2019, when I said, I predict that next year, 2020, is going to be the first year in the history of restaurants that Americans are going to spend more money on food that they take away from restaurants than food that they eat in restaurants, given trends. Wow. Now, I was clearly
little
right.
Did you know.
I was right for that. Yeah. I was right for reasons
yikes,
that I couldn't
Derek.
Get even close to predicting. Yeah, I guess for that reason, I should stop making predictions entirely, lest I accidentally trigger more pandemics.
Yeah, exactly.
But so this is a case where the trend line was already pointing that way. And so, yeah, I absolutely think that given pre-pandemic trends and the pulse of the pandemic, you are absolutely going to see an ongoing increase in the share of retail that is delivered rather than consumed on premise.
Let me read a Facebook comment from Lynette. My husband's team have a weekly game over Zoom. It's just 1 hour a week, but it seems to help reset moods. Barbara, we're almost out of time, but that seems like something you might suggest.
Absolutely, something I have suggested actually to many employers. There are, I think you want to be sensitive to the amount of screen time your folks are spending already. You know, and for some employees, this is the last thing they want to do is spend another hour of time on the screen. But find a way to connect your people, whether it's game day, you know, game afternoon, whether it is unstructured remote working, whatever it is. You know, interest groups, find a way, because that's going to be what keeps you going.
Barbara Larson, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Lovely to be here again. Thanks, Marty.
Nice to have you on again. And Derek Thompson, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And thanks for all those comments. And as I said, this is part of a series we're going to do Fridays in February, looking at how the pandemic has changed the world of work. On next Friday, I think we're going to be talking about essential workers, the kind of opposite of what we were talking about today. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Henson. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.